Okay, welcome to class. Thank you for coming out. Did any of you do your assignment? The one on the board, the part about which grammar concepts you'd like to talk about. Or maybe you know, understand them all already. Go ahead.
I looked at it, but I don't know which one I'm going to do.
All right. Because what I'd like to do, for the sake of those of you who weren't here yesterday, we started by looking at some general concepts about English grammar. By the way, what are the two rules of English grammar? Rules, in quotes. Yes, rule one says every rule in the English language is at least one exception. Rule two?
If there is no exception, see rule one.
Exactly. And there is definitely a grain of truth to that. But like I said, let's embrace those exceptions. They are what make our language beautiful. Four reasons. Why do we teach and study English grammar? It teaches us to communicate clearly. It helps us learn new languages. It builds our reading comprehension. And it trains our mind. It has been said that English is a history of invasions. We looked at five of those six invasions yesterday. First, we had the Celts, and they impacted our language very, very little, actually. The Roman occupation had definitely more of an impact. And then, of course, the major impact, the Anglo-Saxons, the Germanic peoples who came over from modern-day Germany. They created Old English as we know it. And then there was the Christian invasion when Pope Gregory sent the missionaries to Christianize the Anglo-Saxons. The Vikings of Denmark were invasion number five. And that's where we stopped yesterday after looking a bit at some of the characteristics of Old English. So we're going to pick up today with the Norman conquest, which was the sixth, last, and most important invasion in the history of the English language. It impacted it more than any other. So much for a bit of review. I'm getting ahead of myself. We want to look at this Norman conquest now and then look at early modern English, basically the time period from 1450 to about 1700, and then some variations of English. I'm glad we have a Canadian here with us today, and you'll understand maybe even better than I do some of those changes there. And then some of the changes that are going on in the English language even today. Then we want to look at grammar concepts, and that's your time. I try to make a fairly comprehensive list there of the concepts in grammar. I'm not saying it is comprehensive. If there's something not on there you want to talk about, go ahead and talk about it. I feel like I'm a little bit out on a limb here because I've got a textbook here. I've taught this stuff, but I didn't study all those concepts in the last 24 hours, so you might catch me flat-footed here, but we can help each other with it. But please, don't leave this class saying, I wish we could have talked about this, because you didn't want to bring it up. So it's going to be your time. We'll try to devote a good part of today's class period to that. Now, backing up a bit to the reasons for teaching grammar, and I'm going to stress this again. I know I talked about this yesterday, but it's important. To me, English grammar is the most important thing we teach in our schools. It's not the funnest. It's not the most exciting. But in the final analysis, while history is great and it's my favorite subject, how much does that have to do with why we're here on Earth today? Math is good. We need it to run a household and to run a business. But what is more important than being able to read the Word of God, to explain it to our children, to our friends, to our neighbors? I have here a writing by John Piper. It comes from his book, Desiring God. And he talks about how the book of Hebrews is an intellectually challenging argument, and you can't understand it just from light skimming. He says, this is an overwhelming argument for giving children a disciplined and rigorous training in how to think an author's thoughts after him from a text, especially a biblical text. An alphabet must be learned as well as vocabulary, grammar, syntax, the rudiments of logic, the way meaning is imparted through sustained connections of sentences and paragraphs. So obviously there's a lot more involved here than just grammar, but grammar is a very important part of that. Education of the mind in the rigorous discipline of thoughtful reading is a primary goal of school. The Church of Jesus is debilitated when his people are lulled into thinking that it is humble or democratic or relevant to give a merely practical education that does not involve the rigorous training of the mind to meditate on and derive meaning from difficult texts. The issue of learning a living is not nearly so important as whether the next generation has direct access to the meaning of the Word of God. We need an education that puts the highest premium under God on knowing the meaning of God's book and growing in the abilities that will unlock its riches for a lifetime. It would be better to starve for lack of food than fail to grasp the meaning of the book of Romans. That, in my mind, is why we teach grammar and why we teach it well. Any comments, questions, anything you want to talk about before we get into the lesson proper? Anything on the board that's bothering you? Okay, all right. I was wondering how long it's going to take for it to come out. I figured we might as well start with a bit of grammatical correction here. By the way, grammatical, is that even a word? Emily, is that a word? I think it is. But, why use a $50 word when a $5 word will suffice? You know, we are looking at grammar concepts. There is absolutely no sense in needlessly complicating simple things. Okay, what do you think here?
Your.
I'm not going to use proper proofreading marks here. Let's just get through it.
Comment after start.
Why?
With the independent clause.
Right. It's an introductory adverb clause. It's one of the four things my students never remember. Remember I told you I'm going to give you those? That's another one of them. Introductory adverb clause must be set off with commas.
I should say and decide.
Yes, decide. We don't shift the number of our verb just because we feel like it.
You need to cross out each one.
Each one. That one, I just threw that in there. That one could be fixed multiple ways. I made it that way on purpose because it created a run-on with an independent clause here. So we obviously had to do something serious there with the joining, but simply getting rid of this makes it no longer be a clause. And by the way, each one is third person. We started in second person. Don't switch your person like that. And here's first person. I mean, have fun while I'm at it. Although, is that acceptable? Yeah, that one is okay because we are shifting the focus from you looking at this to we all together talking about it. Is there anything else? If you're waiting for class to start, please study over the list of grammar concepts on your handout and decide which ones we should talk about. This is maybe not grammar, but if is the wrong word there. It's not if you're waiting, it's while you're waiting. Some of those, I don't know, you call a small detail, but in my mind, that's the difference between the seventh grader who knows how to write and the seventh grader who just throws words on paper because the teacher says, I have to write a composition. And some of those little details can be very helpful. There is another problem. Yes, this is handout. One word here. There might be more. I don't know. I'm not. My grammar is not perfect. Okay, the Norman Conquest took place in the year 1066, the most definitive event in English history as a whole, speaking of the nation of England, but also the English language. There's an interesting story comes from it. William the Conqueror, who was Duke of Normandy in northern France, decided he wanted the throne of England, and there's a long, complicated story there involving Danish kings with unpronounceable names who died without heirs and all sorts of stuff, and William the Conqueror felt he had a claim to the throne. So he didn't just one day wake up and say, I want England. He felt he had a legitimate claim to the throne. Well, King Harold, on the throne of England, felt he did not, obviously. And that's why there was a battle. William the Conqueror landed there on the shores of England, and as he got off the boat, he tripped and fell. And his superstitious soldiers freaked out. They said, this is a bad omen. We're going to lose the battle. He said, no, I've already got the soil of England in my hands. And he went on to defeat King Harold, whose forces were extremely tired and exhausted because of just having fought the Vikings in the northern part of England only 2 or 3 weeks earlier. Why was this important? Well, the Normans were Frenchmen, and they brought the French language with them. He required French to be used in all official and governmental functions, including the schools. So if you were a school child in the year 1066, suddenly your education shifted from English to French. And, of course, French comes directly from Latin, and so basically this is the Latin language invading England at this time. About 30% of the words we commonly use have come into our language as a result of the French invasion, the Norman conquest. But French did not entirely replace English. Instead, the commoners kept talking English. You can't change a commoner's mindset just because you tell him he has to talk French. They kept talking English, but all official business, all writing was done in French, and so English, Old English, of course it was at that time, became more a spoken language only. And so a lot of the upper class words fell out of use and were forgotten, were replaced by Norman French words. But the common words didn't. And so that's why today we have so many pairs. We have begin and commence, English and French. We have sin, crime. Talked about this one yesterday. Question, interrogate. Notice in each case that the French word is more highbrow. It's more, you know, it's a high. That was the way it was. I mentioned yesterday about the Anglo-Saxon words, the Old English words being more short and forceful, and how Churchill was a fan of that. And he had that entire speech there: "We will not flag or fail. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight in the landing fields. We shall never surrender," which is a Latin, a Norman French word. This period became known as Middle English because of all the changes that English went through. By the end of this time period, it was no longer recognizable as the earlier language because of the mixing that went on. One good thing that happened out of this, I told you yesterday that our language has a fairly simple grammar when compared to other languages as far as inflections. A lot of these inflections fell out of use then because, remember, it's the uneducated, it's the common folks who are talking language. And you know how common folks talk. They don't get all the finer points. And so a lot of the more complicated inflections fell out of use. We have a few left. Today I eat, yesterday I ate, every day I have eaten. That's a really unusual verb form. It's a very common verb. It's a non-issue to us. But it's, think of those inflections. It's not your typical ED. It's very different, actually. Other EN verbs like swollen, shaven, molten, those are leftovers from the Old English period. Because Old English was so highly inflected, word order didn't really matter, much like classical Latin. But as these endings were dropped, suddenly word order became important. And that's why today you have to get your subjects and direct objects in the right place, or you're going to say the opposite of what you want to say. There were very few written works of literature during this early Middle English period. Wycliffe's Bible and Chaucer's Canterbury Tales were the main ones. And because of that, they had an outsized influence on the language and on language unification. Because whoever could read didn't have a whole lot to read besides those works. We saw in our study of the invasions yesterday that there were three different times when the Latin language influenced English. This one was by far the largest. And now that we're at the end of the invasions, let's sum up a bit where English comes from. About 75% of the words in the English language, generally speaking, not including the technical terms, come from Latin and Greek. You say, why Greek? Because the Romans were admirers of Greek culture. They borrowed a lot of Greek words, integrated it into their language. When we borrowed all the Latin, we got the Greek with it. Our most commonly used 10,000, or our 10,000 most commonly used words, are over half Latin and Greek roots today. Another inheritance from Latin is irregular plurals. You have one cactus, but two
cacti.
One vertebra, vertebrae, emphasis, emphases, datum. We don't even recognize that word anymore. You know it's plural, though. Data. And we talk about data all the time. And data is plural because it's multiple pieces of information. One piece of information is a datum. But what's funny, and I'm going to talk about back formation later on here. Back formation is when we take a word and make other words from it without using our heads. And sometimes it works, like editor. We think today one who edits, well, edit was not the root of editor. It was editor, and we made edit from it in back formation. You know, one of these days, someone's going to take the word beaver and make beeve out of it as back formation. That's what is happening with data. They're now using data as a singular. It's not. They've forgotten our Latin roots. Radius, should be familiar with this from math class. Radii. Okay, so that's the Norman invasion there. Now, looking at early modern English, 1450 to 1700, a lot of interesting changes here. Remember that the printing press was developed about this time. This brought a certain amount of standardization because as printing came about, people accepted printed works as more authoritative. You know, if someone sends you a letter, it's handwritten versus type. Typing is more official, right? Especially back in the day when there wasn't a lot of that. But like we mentioned yesterday, printers were known to double letters and add silent E's and all sorts of stuff if it helped fill out their lines of type. The great vowel shift in the 15th century also impacted English a lot. The letter O originally had a long A sound. So the word stone would have been stain. Today it's stone. Also, the letter I shifted from a long E to a long I sound. Some of this great vowel shift, of course, this occurred in the 15th century, but vowel sounds continue to morph and change a bit. A Westerner has a little bit different way of pronouncing some of his vowels than some of us from farther east. Canadians have different sounds on some of their vowels as well. So, I don't know, maybe it's a small vowel shift. But the great vowel shift really impacted English pronunciation. Also, during this time, some previously voiced consonants became silent. Why is lamb spelled with a B on the end? Because they used to pronounce it. Lamb. Well, it's no wonder they dropped it. A knife used to be knife. The K was pronounced and the E was pronounced. Half. I'm not sure how you get that L in there. Half. Tough. You know, so all the exceptions in the English language, well, here we go. We used to pronounce these words. And then the Renaissance came along. And the Renaissance, of course, brought a continent-wide increase in learning and study and writing. And English speakers began saying, hey, we need to have works of literature in our own language, not just Latin stuff. John Skelton, Sir Thomas Eliot, Sir Thomas More greatly increased English vocabulary they wrote. And as they wrote, if they didn't have a word that fitted what they wanted to say, they coined it. And usually they used a Latin word and based an English word off it because they were familiar with Latin already. William Tyndale did a masterful job of translating the Bible into simple yet profound English. And his translation, actually, we read today. We think of it being the King James, and it is the King James, but they borrowed so heavily from William Tyndale's work that his influence is probably one of the stronger influences in the King James Bible today yet. Speaking of writers and coiners of words and influencers of English in this time period, who's the number one? I haven't mentioned him yet. William Shakespeare, absolutely. He wrote many plays during the 1600s, and he freely coined words. He used words as other parts of speech. If he had a word that was a noun and it had never yet been used as a verb, and it fit, he did. You know, because he was writing his plays as poetry, and so he had to have meter, he had to have rhyme. And so if he didn't have enough words to fit it, he made it, and they were so popular, so well used. He also gets credit for a lot of our expressions. You've heard of, come on, let's get going, we're burning daylight. Burning daylight comes from Shakespeare's works. It was Greek to me, Shakespeare. So much more. Read his works if you can sometime. Well, you can read them. That's not an issue. If you can understand them, it's even better. I struggle. I struggle tremendously. I have a complete works of Shakespeare with some side notes in, some printed in, and then the former owner of the book pencils some stuff in. Very, very helpful. Because he's writing in nearly 400-year-old English. English has shifted a lot since then. Plus, he was a lot smarter than I was. The average Englishman of Shakespeare's time had a much, much larger vocabulary than the average American today does. Unfortunate, but true. In the late 16, early 1700s, then, there was a movement in learned circles to promote the establishment of a society to govern correct usage of English. Remember, this is still before the Industrial Revolution in communication and transportation, and so there's all these dialects and all this different stuff going on, and they want to pull this together. Nothing official was ever done. But Samuel Johnson published the Dictionary of the English Language in 1755, and it was widely used and was considered authoritative. Now, he was a bit eccentric in some ways. He sometimes put in his own definitions. For example, if you would read in his dictionary on what oats are, it says, he was an Englishman, okay, and the Englishman didn't like the Scots. He says, oats are a grain in England primarily fed to horses, but in Scotland they are used for human consumption. And the Scots were not happy with that definition. Some of his other definitions were so complicated that you almost needed to look up other words to figure it out. Like a network is an intersection of lines vesicated with reticules. I don't know what that means. But his work had the effect of an informal academy in standardizing English pronunciation. Noah Webster, an American now this time, wanted American English to be distinctly different from British English. And of course, you know him as the man who published the Blueback Speller, a dictionary. We still use Webster's dictionary today. But he promoted spelling changes that Americans adopted, especially after the Revolutionary War, because we don't want to be like the British. Canadians did not, because they never had that rebellious streak in them. How do you spell the word center? Jeff?
C-E-N-T-R-E.
Right. Noah Webster wanted that switch. Noah Webster also said, don't waste use in words like color. You would still spell that with a U, right? What about music? Do you end music with a K?
No.
Okay. That was an older British usage that I thought had kind of fallen by the wayside, but I wasn't quite sure where that, and maybe they do still in Britain, I don't know, because I'm sure there are differences between Canadian and British English.
Because we get a lot of French input into ours too.
So. Right, right. What about check? Like writing out a check to pay somebody?
It's the official Canadian spelling is C-H-E-Q-U-E.
The Q-U-E spelling,
which
okay.
Which is generally used, but yeah. The American form.
The American form is coming in. Yeah. Right. Another factor that majorly impacted English during the later part of the early modern period was the size and global reach of the British Empire. You know, they said the sun never sets on the British Empire. I think as a Frenchman said, yes, yeah, because God can't leave the British alone in the dark. You don't trust him. But it had a worldwide reach. And English spread to all corners of the globe. And then you've got American and American imperialism. And so that contributed to the wide use of English, but also it worked the other way. It contributed to a wide use of loan words, because as the English language went into other countries, some of those words were picked up and used in our language as well. It's interesting. I was visiting Spain a number of years ago, and we with a friend of mine, and we stayed at his friend's house in Madrid. He is a native Spaniard, speaks good English, somewhat accented. His wife was a Russian Mennonite raised in Mexico, whose grandpa left. No, her grandpa was Russian Mennonite. Her dad left the Russian Mennonites as a young man, moved to New York City, and became basically a Mexican American. And she then married Bonnie, her husband's name, because he was an exchange student. They live in Spain today, so when she talks English, she sounds like an American. He definitely has an accent. She does not. But she is very high in Spain's Ministry of Education, and so high, in fact, that when the EU meets in educational matters, She sits at the Spain desk. And the official language of the EU is French because it's headquartered in Brussels, Belgium. But she said everyone talks English except the French minister and the Belgian minister. And when they talk and they start talking French, everyone puts their headphones on for translation. But the interesting part is that when the British rep starts talking, everybody's like, talk English! Because they're talking British English, and it is today it is American English that has spread through much of the world. And so all these other people, she as the Spanish rep, which of course with her American upbringing, that's kind of a different matter, but the other representatives speak American English. So I find it interesting how American English has replaced British English. Not entirely sure that's all for the good, because I'm fascinated by some of the Britishisms in the language. Where am I now? That was a bunny trail. I'm sorry. I wasn't watching the clock. Spelling is very inconsistent in the English language. People have tried to propose ways of standardizing it. It hasn't taken hold because people are too used to it. I personally am glad they didn't. Maybe that's not fair because I never struggled with spelling in school. But because a spelling is not standardized, we can tell where words come from. Mosquito is Spanish. That I with the E sound, that ending with O, Dachshund, is German. We borrowed those words. Folk etymology is interesting. We've gotten some strange words from that. Woodchuck comes from the Cree word ochek, and it just kind of sounded like woodchuck, so that's where woodchuck came from. It has nothing to do with throwing wood, despite the tongue twister. The Texas 10-gallon hats. In my boyhood, I tried to imagine how big a hat would have to be to hold 10 gallons of water. The gallon comes from the Spanish word galón, which means line of braid. The 10-gallon hats were made with 10 lines of braid. The Americans just said, oh, gallon. Have you ever heard of sparrowgrass? Sparrowgrass. That was a folk etymological back formation from asparagus because it sounded like it, and they would call it sparrowgrass. That one got hit hard enough by the arbiters of proper English, that was just about disappeared. But if you don't like asparagus, you can call it sparrowgrass and make people who like it mad. What about some recent change, some changes today in English? Well, we have a lot of interesting things. For example, pasteurizing milk. That comes from Louis Pasteur, who's the one who developed the system. Another Frenchman, Louis Guillotine, invented the guillotine because it was supposed to be a more humane way of killing people, and it ended up being a faster way of killing more people. Wasn't what he wanted. Calico fabric came from Calicut, today Calcutta, India. Muslin fabric came from Mosul, M-O-U-S-L, in Iraq. Someone have a correct pronunciation on that? Anyway, something like that. Jeans. That word comes from cloth that was made in Genoa. Greek mythology has given us all sorts of interesting terms, words, concepts like the Achilles heel, Cassandra, Odyssey, a long trip after Odysseus and his mythological journey. Expressions in the English language. Last week we took a trip with our youth group to southern Louisiana. And toward the sugar plantations there. And they told us about the concept of sell down the river. The sugar plantations were the absolute worst work a black slave could be put to, and that was what they had there. Okay. Sorry. We were going to talk about grammar today. What do you want to talk about tomorrow? Thank you.
Okay.
I have until...
You have until 4. Oh, 3, I mean.
3. Okay, yeah. Much better. Yeah. Much better. Okay, right. Good. We can keep going here. Clipped words. Any horsemen or horse ladies here? Okay. The pace called a canter. What's the advantage with that? Is it fast? Comfortable?
It's not very sustainable, but it's very fast.
Not very sustainable, but very fast. Okay. Canter comes from the word Canterbury, Canterbury was a famous pilgrimage destination in England, and it came from the speed at which people would go to Canterbury. So they were in a hurry, apparently. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Of course, we know math and exam are clipped forms. Nothing much to that. When teaching acute angles in math, have you ever told your students that the acute angle is smaller, you know, so it's cute? I have. I didn't know until I was preparing for this that cute is actually a clipped form of acute. So if you're really smart, you have an acute intelligence, you have a cute brain, I guess. Drawing room. You read those old Victorian stories of how the people would eat their meals in the parlor and then go to the drawing room? That's a clipped form. Withdrawing room. Oh, I always wonder what kind of art they did in the drawing room. They withdrew from the parlor. You know, the men would withdraw to smoke their cigars or something. Okay. We have semantic change. Changes in the meaning of language. Expedient. What does expedient mean?
Necessary.
Advantageous, important, whatever. Notice here the root ped. The Latin root ped, it means foot. Ex means out of. And expedient used to be freeing one caught by the foot. Semantic change. Change in the meaning of language. Salient. If a speaker makes a salient point, it's important, it's obvious, you need to get this, you know? Why do we teach English? It comes from the Latin root salire, which means to jump. So salient used to have the idea of jumping. So I don't know, I guess the salient point jumps at you. I find some of those etymological meanings to be somewhat helpful in understanding those words today. Modernism and pop culture have influenced the language, you know. It was like 95 degrees out there. My favorite reply to that is, what was the temperature actually? There's a constant shifting of usage labels, new definitions. What's not acceptable today is acceptable tomorrow. I told you yesterday that leg was inappropriate for mixed company. Pants also. That's where trousers came into the language. It was more proper than pants. So there's a shifting in our language shifts with that. And I don't have a lot more to say on that, but I think that we as godly people, plain conservative people, could maybe do a little bit better at being careful where we pick up our language. It comes a lot of it from pop culture. And often we find ourselves using words, and once we know what they mean, we're like, are you serious? Maybe we should slow down a bit. The woke movement, cancel culture, very recent developments here have impacted language. Have you noticed how especially liberal news magazines have started capitalizing the letter B in the word black when referring to the black people? Why? It's some type of virtue signaling, is showing how the blacks are important. Black is still not a proper noun. I'm going to stick to that rule, sorry. Maybe someone of you has a little more of the backstory on this, but recently at the opening of a session of Congress, in the House of Representatives, the pastor who led the invocation ended his prayer with amen and a women. What I don't know is, was he doing it to poke fun at the woke movement, or was he literally trying to keep everybody happy? Does someone have more of the backstory on that? Anyway, a little pathetic there. Unlearn and unteach are becoming popular. You know, we have to unlearn our patterns of racist thinking, and it takes a lot of unteaching in schools to make that happen. Well, you're not unteaching, you're just teaching something different. So our language continues changing. We don't use equality anymore, we talk about equity. Which, by the way, equity has to do with your balance sheet in the business, I thought. But anyway. Okay, what should we talk about? Were any comments or questions?
Just one quick question. You said Wycliffe's Bible and what other book?
The Canterbury Tales by Chaucer. Yes. And actually, that is one of the more difficult things for students to get their minds around. I've got that in point G, number 5. Let's just go ahead. I'm going to look at that a little bit, try to pull some things together on that so I don't say it wrong the first time here. And if any of the rest of you have more things, call it out.
Language is shifting all the time. So my question is, things that are not proper, ain't, for instance. How much of a stickler should we be about those things that at one time were not proper but are pretty rapidly getting there? How much should we be sticklers for that kind of thing?
Good question. I'm probably not the best one to ask because I use ain't. But I don't use it in formal settings. If it would come out now, I would correct myself, or I would want to at least. I won't use it in writing. I won't let my students use it in writing. But we're out on the playground. In my mind, that was shifting now. But hey, I'm pretty young, you know. And go ahead, contradict me. I don't care. Another thing with that is we probably all have our own little pet peeves. Mine, as you probably picked up, is like. So I'm going to step all over that one. Maybe you are okay with like and don't like ain't. You know, I think there's some room for some of that. I do think it's important that we, again, as Christian people, know how to speak in a proper, not highbrow, but educated manner. You know, how much are you going to take off a salesman if he can't use proper grammar? We're salesmen of the gospel of Christ. I hate to use such a vulgar term, but you get what I'm saying. Anything more on that or grammar concepts?
I teach my children in story writing. We use conversational English.
True.
But I want to keep them from going too far because soon we're sounding just like the world. For instance, let's not overuse like and ain't just to make our conversation sound
right. Right. And like it or not, even a story carries a certain degree of authority. Maybe not as much as a work of literature or an essay, and yet it still does. And if our stories sound exactly like we do in everyday language, it's going to keep lowering standards. But at the same time, at the risk of sounding overly critical here, who says, Father said, come into the study with me, you must be punished? You know, okay, so there's a balance there. My favorite method of teaching grammar concepts is to use a flowchart whenever possible. And tomorrow we'll be spending some time on how to teach grammar concepts, how to make them stick. Flowchart, I propose to you as one of the best. Maybe you have better ones. So I'll use my flowchart here on verb types. I have about half a dozen flowcharts here. I'll probably pass them around tomorrow. You may not copy them, as in on the copy machine. You may write them down yourselves, because the act of writing them down is beneficial. But then also, if you want to use them in your classroom, you must make your students copy their own as well. There's just something about that that is so beneficial, and so I'm going to be a stickler there. Sorry.
Can we take some diagramming and do something?
What's that?
Diagramming, I saw on here.
You wanted to talk about like diagramming.
I'd actually like to talk about everything that you have written.
Right. Right. Well, hey, if nobody else has any ideas, we'll just talk about everything. Well, we'll take verb types right now. There are two basic types of verbs in the English language. First of all, we have action verbs, and then we have
being
verbs.
Action verbs can further be divided into two categories. Intransitive verbs. By the way, what does transitive mean?
Shifting or moving.
Shifting or moving. Passing across is the definition I like to use. This may be a little simpler for students to get. And so a transitive verb passes action across to something, to a receiver. Intransitive is not transitive. It does not pass action on. And so in the intransitive point, we have the intransitive complete verb, which for the sake of time, I'm going to abbreviate as IC. The intransitive complete verb, the subject performs the action, but there is no receiver. And typically I would write that as well, but I'm racing the clock today. The transitive verb can be divided into two categories, transitive active and transitive passive. Can someone give me the difference between an active and a passive verb?
Active does the action, passive receive.
Correct. In a transitive active sentence, the direct object is the receiver. The subject is the doer. In a transitive passive sentence, the subject is the receiver. And the object of the preposition is the doer. If it shows up, it might not. On the bottom of this flowchart, which I'll pass around either later today or tomorrow, I then have a sample sentence for each verb type. The intransitive, now let me start with the transitive active verb type. John hit the ball. No, I'm sorry, it doesn't have a lot of imagination, but let me tell you, all my sentences in English class have to do with John hitting the ball. And after a while, it's a big joke, and they're like, okay, what's John? How is John going to deal with the ball this time? You know, so, no, it doesn't have the imagination. One of my friends said he'd rather have John hit Jay. You know, that's more interesting. Well, maybe it is, but we've created our own level of affection for John and his adventure with the ball. So we have John hit the ball right here, okay? Transitive passive.
The ball was hit by John.
Exactly. The ball was hit by John. And we have here a little side note here. A transitive passive verb. Verb must be third principal part with form of be as a helping verb. And if your students have trouble with active versus passive verbs, drill this thing until they know it in their sleep. Because you can look at a verb and you can very quickly tell. Well, first of all, if it's not a verb phrase, it will never be passive. Because it needs that helping verb. And then, if it's not third principal part, you know, if it ends in ing, or s, or e, you know, whatever, it can't be. It's a very narrow window there. Is that the ideal way of doing it? Ideally, you know, you should look at the verb and say, well, what's receiving the action here? Well, some students can't see through that. They can usually see through that, at least in my experience. Over here on the intransitive complete, my sample sentence is John swung wildly at the ball. And it's important that we use an action verb like swung because something's happening. There's just nothing receiving the action. The air, I guess, but, you know. Now, over here on the being side, every being verb is also called a linking verb. Why do I put that on a separate level in the flowchart? Because sometimes we have a bit of confusion between the terminologies there. Linking, then, we call those intransitive linking verbs. And by the way, there's a lesson in the 7th grade English book on the 4 verb types. They use those 4 abbreviations. They always struggle with the lesson. It's too short. There aren't enough points on it. They get a bad grade on it. This flowchart came out of my sweat and toil and tears over that lesson. An intransitive linking verb will always have a predicate nominative or a predicate adjective. There are 3 groups of linking verbs. The be verbs, of course, and typically I would write these down, and are the verb, be, been, being. And then the sometimes linking verbs, taste, feel, smell, sound. Look, appear, thank you. And grow, seem, stay, become, remain. A bit of a moment. And my sample sentence for intransitive linking, John was not the ball. Okay, because ball there is the predicate nominative, renaming John. So we have to put that not in there, obviously. But
go ahead and pass that around.
That is verb types. Quickly, was that sufficient?
Diagramming is fun. One day, we diagrammed Hebrews 1:1-4. That's an entertaining assignment. If you need something to do tonight, work at it. There's a lot there, and the diagram is amazing. If we get time, maybe we can do it. If not, I can at least let you look at the diagram. You can get a feeling of how big it is. I'll have a few more comments on diagramming tomorrow. Anything else besides the very helpful word everything? Adjective, adverb, confusion. If you tell me now, I have more time to get my act together. I can maybe do a better job of it tomorrow. But if you do come up with something overnight, that is fine as well. What I do have planned for tomorrow is to look at... No, let's do it this way. I have a section on my notes about helping our students overcome bad attitudes about grammar. But this class is small enough here. If you don't have students who have bad attitudes about grammar, or you're on the way of mastering it, we'll skip that part on my notes. Should we skip it? You feel like you need it. Okay. Yours have bad attitudes. Okay. We'll talk about it. You don't have a bad attitude, do you? That's a sneak preview for tomorrow. And then a few points on how to teach grammar practically. I'm going to talk some more about flowcharts, simplicity, participation, the board, diagramming, things like that. And then we'll end up with some interesting things relating to the English language. One day at the dinner table, this is before we had any children, or at least children old enough to eat from the table, we were eating a peanut butter pie. And we had had it Sunday for lunch. Peanut butter pie is pretty much the best pie out there, by the way. And we had had it Sunday for lunch. I think we had another time. Anyway, there's one piece left, okay? We're fairly newly married here, but I like peanut butter pie. So I said, I like peanut butter pie better than you. I like peanut butter pie better than you like peanut butter pie, of course. You're dismissed.